Are African Americans less interested in the environment, not as comfortable in nature as their white peers, or maybe even in some ways excluded from those spaces? Professor Carolyn Finney of the University of California, Berkeley, looks at those questions and possible reasons why in her new book, Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship of African Americans to the Great Outdoors. Professor Finney, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, you start off with a personal story of your own interest in the land. Can you start us off with that?
I can, because this project, you know, this project was really a personal one, or it started from a personal place. I grew up about a half an hour outside of New York City in Westchester County. My parents came from Virginia, had a high school education. When my dad got done with the Korean War, like a lot of African Americans in the 50s who were living in the South, they came north hoping that they would have better job opportunities. And when he got to New York, he basically had two job options. He could be a janitor in Syracuse, New York, which is about 5 hours upstate, or he could be a caretaker for a wonderful estate about 30 minutes outside of the city owned by a very wealthy Jewish family. And that's the job he took. So my parents were the caretakers, gardeners, chauffeur, housekeeper for that estate for 50 years. They lived in the gardener's cottage on that estate. They wanted to have kids. I tell people they thought they couldn't have kids, so they adopted me. And then, like I like to say, they relaxed, and so I have two brothers. my brothers and I grew up on this estate. It's a 12-acre estate. It has a swimming pool, a pond, gardens, lots of different kinds of wildlife on this estate. And we basically had the run of that estate during the week because the owners generally only came up on the weekends and holidays. It's a very wealthy white neighborhood. We were the only family of color in that neighborhood. And so one of the stories I often tell in presentations is that I say that when I was nine, I remember walking home from school one day and, you know, fourth grade, had my school bag, and there were always policemen patrolling the neighborhood. And I got stopped by this white policeman who wanted to know where I was going. And I told him, because I was just around the corner from the house. And then he looked at me and he said, "Oh, do you work there?" And I remember thinking, I'm nine, you know? No, and all I could say to him was, "No, I live there." But I think that was one of those moments that I really understood that the color of my skin really challenged any logical idea he might have, looking at a little nine-year-old girl with her school bag and imagining she couldn't possibly live here in this neighborhood, so she must work here, even though I was only 9 years old. So I just want to flash forward a little bit. When I really started thinking about this as a project, I had gone back to school later on in life, and in the early 2000s, I was working on my doctorate, and I thought my parents were still on this property, but at this point, the original owners had died. And to their credit, before they died, the family understood what's going to happen to my parents, who are now much older. And it's much more challenging to care for a big property like that when you get older. And so they eventually had a house built for them back in Virginia. And so my parents were still on the property, though, part-time. And they finally moved. And that they've been living in Leesburg, Virginia now for about, I guess, 10 years or so. My father has been pretty depressed the whole time, ever since he left New York. And I think one of the things that got me motivated to think about land, ownership, environment, whose story counts, is both my parents, my father's depression about leaving that land. What does it mean? What does real ownership mean? They cared for that land for 50 years. But they could never own that land because they could never afford it. The property taxes alone at that time are over $125,000 a year, and my parents would never be able to afford anything like that. There's now a conservation easement on the property because the new owner decided he was going to have that done, and a letter went out to all the neighbors in the area, and somebody sent a copy of the letter to my parents to say, "Oh, you need to know this is what's happening with the property now." And I read the letter because they showed me the copy, and the Westchester Conservation Organization was saying, really thanking the new owner for his conservation-mindedness, was really saying, you know, this is really important in the watershed there, you know, all the birds and flora and fauna that are on this property, you know, and we're really kind of congratulating him on making this choice. But there was nothing in the letter thanking my parents, the people who cared for that land for 50 years, which really started me thinking about a lot of people throughout this country who have cared for, who have worked land for long periods of time, but their story, their experience, you know, we don't hear about that.
And a lot of the things you just mentioned point toward a big theme in your book, whether we're talking about the policeman or that letter to your parents. Mm-hmm. When we think of environment, we associate white faces with people owning the land, enjoying the land, conserving the land. Is that common for white and African Americans?
Well, let me just be really, I want to make sure that I'm not speaking for all black people or white people either, right? So I sort of make this. My opinion is partially based on the research I've done, my own personal experience, talking to a lot of different people, and the reading that I've done in my own perspective. So I really want to put that out
sure.
there. So I'm not saying that this is the way it is. But I think that when I think about the founding of this country, and I say that in quotes too, that, you know, and the national parks as one way within which, you know, how America kind of created an identity for itself to say, you know, we have these incredible outdoor natural spaces like the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone, and this really says something about who we are as a people and a place. But to understand that the founding of those parks partially happened because Native Americans were removed from that land. At the time that that founding happened, at the time that European Americans, many were coming over here and were able to claim land under the Homestead Act, black people who were recently freed from being slaves could not participate in that land grab. So when I think about, and this is just really broad strokes, but really just thinking about those founding narratives about who we are, who the environment is, what land looks like, what our relationship to the environment should look like when I think about conservation as a field or preservation, John Muir, all of these ideas. I'm not denigrating the ideas, but these ideas come from a very particular perspective, which is why I think we often think of white faces as controlling the mainstream environmental movement and sort of being central to this kind of environmental narrative. But there's a whole lot of other environmental narratives out there that are taking place, that have always been taking place at the same time.
And that's a big point you make in your book, that you'd like to see in the media, in national park literature, you'd like to see those narratives alongside the ones that are already there. What kind of things would you like to see?
Oh, I would like to see so many things. I was so privileged to talk with and meet so many amazing people and their stories. And so I tell a few of them because I was just blown away by how creative and innovative was. So when I think about somebody like, and actually you all in Wisconsin probably know him, John Francis.
Yes, he's been on this network, definitely.
Exactly, right. I mean, when I met John, I met him one time at a conference and I just followed him around. I was like, John, I must be your friend.
Well, do tell his story though. Remind us of that, please.
His story of, you know, he lived out here in the Bay Area back in the 70s and there was a small oil spill that happened, and it had upset him so much that he decided he wasn't going to take any motorized transport for a while. And he said he did that for like a week or so, but he was always getting in arguments with his friends and everything because he wouldn't get in their trucks or in their cars or take a ride. So he eventually decided he was going to stop talking. And for the next 22 years, John walked across the United States and Latin America to raise awareness about the environment. He did that for 17 years without talking. He got his PhD at University of Wisconsin without talking. I think about his story, and his story, I must say, in the last couple of years, is getting more traction in the mainstream. But I think the environmental movement as a whole has been slow to adopt him as a kind of story, not just for black people, but for everyone to relate to. Or the story of Mavine Betch, the beach lady from American Beach off the coast on Amelia Island off the coast of Jacksonville, Florida. Mavine Betch gave away all her wealth to environmental causes, over $750,000 to that. And she worked really hard to protect. American Beach was a black beach in the 40s and 50s in Florida because her great-grandfather, he was a millionaire. But in the South, during the time of Jim Crow, you know, black people couldn't go to the beaches that white people were going to. And so her great-grandfather bought that strip of beach. So it would be a place that black people could own homes on the beach. You could be a judge. You could be a janitor. But you could own a home on the beach. Your family could come to the beach. And she really worked hard before her death to preserve not just the beach, because developers, you know, wanted to come in and buy up that property and put in yet another golf course and the maritime forest that was there and the beautiful sand dunes that were there. she really saw a need to protect them, but also to protect the African-American history of that place, and that those two things are intertwined, that the story is as important as the natural environment itself, because it's something that goes together. There's a relationship there. I could keep talking. You know, Rob, you have to stop me because I have so many stories that I could tell of incredible people, black people around the country who are thinking outside of the box, who are doing the work, sometimes doing the work and not recognizing it as green or environmental, you know, but they are doing the work because they see that it needs to be done, like Brenda Palms Barber in Chicago, who's working with previously incarcerated black men and women, you know, who come out of jail, can't get a job, and now she's got them making urban honey and has a very successful business, Sweet Beginnings. That's a green business.
How does telling and hearing those stories change the way African Americans think about the land and nature and everybody else, too, for that matter?
I think that's right. I think that, so it's something I was just saying last night to some people. I was saying, you know, I think everybody's got a good story. And there's always something there that we all can learn from. So, yes, I believe these stories are something that we all can learn from. But in particular, one of the things I discovered in talking to a lot of different black people across the country was when I would start interviewing them and talking to them and sometimes saying, so tell me your story. And sometimes they would say to me, oh, you know, I don't have an environmental story. I don't have a story. And I would have to stop them and say, you know, everybody's got a story. And part of that indicated to me the way, you know, nature and environment has been framed and largely talked about actually unintentionally perhaps excludes other people from that conversation because they think, oh, you know, I can't talk about it like that. My story of nature and the environment doesn't look like that. My family didn't go to the national parks. I probably didn't go to my first national park till I was sometime in my 30s, you know, which I'm on the National Parks Advisory Board now. But I mean, but I was outside all the time, and as was my family. So part of it for me is also getting people, primarily people who work in environmental institutions and organizations that want to engage difference, broadly defined, to really see those stories differently, right? To see those stories as having creative potential in terms of how those environmental organizations do their work and engage diverse communities. Does that make sense?
I think so. One thing I wanted to get to that struck me, and you talked to a lot of people, as you said, couple quotes that point toward almost a fear of nature. Quote, the tree is associated with lynching, end quote, and there's a lot of trees in those woods and rope is cheap. How much did the slavery era and the era of lynching going all the way well into the 1900s, how much has that shaped the way people think of trees and by extension nature?
So I have to preface this too. I really, you know, at the end of the book, I start off by talking about fear. And one of the reasons I do that is because a number of people had asked me to talk about that. But surprisingly, actually, it was often white scholars or other people working with me wanted me to talk about that fear. And I think that that fear is real. But I want to really emphasize that the fear is not the thing, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if I think collectively about African Americans and living through slavery, Jim Crow segregation, racial profiling, redlining, all the things that we have experienced collectively and continue to experience in this country, that if we were totally only motivated by our fear, I don't think we would make any kind of movement forward at all. For me, it's really about the resilience, that in spite of or despite of these things happening, how we manage to think more expansively about who we are, what a tree actually means, what it means for us to go into the woods. Having said that, I think we can also be a practical people, like anybody was. You want to protect yourself no matter what the color of your skin is. And so understanding the history of this country, for me, the history isn't simply something in the past. There's a legacy of that in the present. I talk about, for instance, in the Jenna tree, that whole story in the last few years about you know, the white kids saying that there was a tree in the schoolyard, but black kids weren't allowed to sit under it. This stuff, these images, these stories, they're coming up all the time. They're spouting up all the time in our consciousness as Americans because it's part of our history. And I think black people are collectively aware of that. So the tree can come to symbolize all kinds of things. I think the Billie Holiday song that Nina Simone and others have sung, Strange Fruit, which is about, you know, that song is really popular, but that song is about lynching. Mm-hmm. And I think there's still some power in the meaning of that. And sometimes you wonder, you know, at small microaggressions as a black person in certain spaces, including outdoor spaces. Outdoor spaces aren't immune from this. But I really want to emphasize that for me, this isn't primarily about the fear. I think the fear is real. I think the history is real. And I think it's there. But I think we're bigger than that.
Carolyn, we are out of time, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
That's Professor Carolyn Finney of the University of California, Berkeley. We've been talking about her book, Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship of African Americans to the Great Outdoors. Coming up after the news, the anniversary of a War of 1812 battle here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.